From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Franz Schubert wrote a masterpiece in his 24-song series Winterreise, or Winter Journey.
Gefrorene Tropfen fallen von meinen Wangen ab.
My guest today, acclaimed English tenor Ian Bostridge, has performed Winterreise, all 70 minutes full of darkness, cold, alienation, maybe 100 times. He is obsessed with this song cycle. He wants to convince you that it is one of the great works of art, that it belongs alongside Shakespeare's poetry, the paintings of Van Gogh and Picasso, the novels of the Bronte sisters, or Marcel Proust. This hour on point, Franz Schubert's Winter Journey. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you ready, prepared to take this journey? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. A special welcome today to our new listeners on 90.1 WFYI in Indianapolis and on WSKG News in New York's Southern Tier and Finger Lakes region. It's great to have all of you with us. Later in this hour, we will spend a few minutes bringing our German musical tour very up to date. But first, Schubert's great song cycle. Ian Bostridge joins me from New York, famed English tenor, well known for his Lieder or German song performances, and a great trained historian. His remarkable new book, Exploration, is Schubert's Winter Journey, Anatomy of an Obsession. And he's out with a big new 3-disc recording of Schubert's song. Ian Bostridge, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
The obsession is yours, sir. How did you gain it?
It started really when I was a teenager. I had a great German teacher, and he came in to a German lesson when I was about 14 or 15. I didn't speak a word of German, really. And he put on a great singer, a great German singer, Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, singing a Schubert song. And I fell in love just with the sound of it, I suppose. And that then drew me to this piece, Winterreise, which is the great piece in that genre. And first of all, to Fischer-Dieskau singing it, and then going to concerts and hearing it, and eventually, when I was about 20 and at college, learning the thing, which I can't imagine now doing that when I was 20.
Lyrics, on and on.
Yeah.
We play a lot of music of all kinds on this show, never with as much German lyric as we're going to hear today. Let's just define a few things here. A song cycle, this is not exactly in fashion any longer. Define Lieder, these songs, and song cycle. What was that form? How was it cultivated?
Well, Lieder really means, it's just the one German word for song.
Right.
There's Gesang, which is another word, and there's Lieder. But I think what happened around the beginning of the 19th century is that the technology of the piano changed, and the piano, instead of becoming this sort of gentle accompanying instrument, became a quasi-orchestral instrument that could provide lots of different colours and an incredible harmonic complexity which would underlie the vocal line. And so what you end up with in Lieder, as invented in a way by Franz Schubert. Beethoven was doing it too a little bit, but it was really Schubert who was at the centre of it. He composed over 600 of these songs. What you find is a dialogue between the piano and the voice, which is sometimes I think of as being like the dialogue between, the conscious and the unconscious mind, the piano as the unconscious mind, but it's also the piano representing things in nature. So you find that a lot in Winterreise. You find
or dogs barking, or ice.
It's almost a joke in that song, I think, because what you have is you have the same figure repeated 3 times, and the singer says, "The chains rattle, the dogs bark, the sleepers yawn."
Use your imagination.
it can represent all those different things.
And a song cycle. We have 24 songs in Winterreise. So, what was the intention of his song cycle?
Well, the intention was to create a unified work of art, I suppose, that would play on people's hearts. But what's not clear is what it was intended for in terms of performance, because it wasn't written to be performed in a concert hall. It wasn't performed in a concert hall as a whole piece until probably the 1860s, more than 40 years after it was written. And I suppose it was for people to have at home, for them to sit at the piano on their own or with, I don't know, with their girlfriend or their boyfriend and sort of look at some of the songs or look at all of the songs and work through their feelings, work through what, you know, what modern academics would call their subjectivity. And it's sort of what pop music does now when teenagers sit on their own in a room and listen to songs about sad, disappointed love. It comes out of Schubert in a way.
We dive here very, very early into the modern, maybe into contemporary pop music in a way. These were poems of Wilhelm Müller that Schubert set to music. Let's dive right in, right from the top. The very first is Gute Nacht, Good Night. And there's an ambiguity around it. You'll introduce us. Here's the song. All right, Ian Bostridge, we're in territory that most of us don't have, maybe on our playlist at home, but wonderful territory here. Of course, it's you singing and you obsessing and analyzing the lyrics here, saying with wonderful ambiguity, I came a stranger, I depart a stranger. May was good to me with many a garland of flowers. The girl, she talked of love, the mother, even of marriage. Now the world is so gloomy, the way is shrouded in snow. And his journey begins. What does that all mean, Ian?
I think what we don't know, we know he's setting out from a house in the middle of the night into a snowy landscape. What we don't know is why he split up with a girl. Was he a commitment phobe? Is he a commitment phobe? Can he not cope with a real relationship? Or did she throw him out? Did the family throw him out because he wasn't rich enough? We get some hints, but we never quite pin it down. And I think it's that ambiguity is crucial all the way through to the way that we can project onto the piece. We can feel it's our piece because we can project our own, the experiences of our own life, our own loves, our own losses into the piece, which makes it very alive for us.
Ambiguity makes it wide open for us. You speculate at one point that maybe he was a tutor to this girl and then overreached and falling in love with her and got...
Well, that was such a common 19th century experience. Mm-hmm. If you look at a lot of the philosophers, the writers of that period, and in fact Schubert himself, they worked as private tutors in families and sometimes they got emotionally involved with their pupils and that was, you know, considered to be really inappropriate for all sorts of reasons.
Yeah, you know, there's such...
Mainly economic reasons, I'd say, but yeah.
Yes, not to mention there was a whole sort of politics around marriage. We'll talk about that. There's such great depth and complexity here, but sonically to a modern ear, this can sound so simple, just piano and voice, and yet you've performed it so many times, you write at such depth about it, and you say this should be right up there in our understanding of art with Shakespeare and Dante and Van Gogh and Picasso and on and on. Why? What puts this song cycle in that league to you?
I think it's expression of the central aspects of human life that were coming into focus at the time it was written. So what I wanted to do in the book is show how it's rooted in those changing perceptions of the human condition in the 1820s and then how it links also to our own notions of what it is to be a human.
Why were those changing? We're in the Napoleonic era here, the Metternich time. What was going on?
I think for the first time, people were coming to terms with the idea of deep time. I mean, this is before Darwin and the discovery of natural selection mm-hmm. and all that sort of thing. But people were beginning to realize that the Earth was very, very old and that it was much older than mankind was and that perhaps mankind was alone in a world without meaning, without a sort of God to anchor that meaning. And he addresses the idea of God directly in a couple of the songs, particularly in one of the songs towards the end called Courage or Mut, where he says, Will kein Gott auf Erden sein, sind wir selber Götter. If there isn't a God on earth, then we're gods ourselves. And that's an incredibly modernist sort of 20th century statement. It anticipates a lot of the existentialism that we find in the early 20th century. And in fact, the piece had a great impact on Samuel Beckett, And Samuel Beckett loved this piece, sang it, listened to it. And I think you can see its influence on his plays as well, in its bareness and its abstractness.
Here's The Weather Vane from Winter Rice, a second song.
Ich schon in meinem Fahne, sie pfiff den armen Flüchtling aus.
We're alone, life may be without meaning, there's an understanding of deep time. There may be some wrestling with sexuality in this song as well, you write in.
Yes, I mean, I think Schubert was subject to the new marriage laws which had been introduced by Metternich in Austria after 1815, which meant that people without sufficient means to support themselves weren't allowed to get married. And I think that has a relevance for Schubert in the context of this piece, where he's not the protagonist has somehow not been allowed to get together with this girl who is described as a reiche Braut, as a rich bride.
And he writes, don't they understand human needs, human nature? Of course, in fact, in life, he was struggling at one eventually here with syphilis, maybe because he couldn't marry and ended up with prostitutes. This would, I guess, lead to his death not long after this very composition.
Yes, I mean, he contracted syphilis in late 1822. He went on to write his first great song cycle, Die Schöne Müllerin, The Beautiful Miller Girl, which is on the outside a sort of simple tale of rusticity, a boy who falls in love with a miller girl who doesn't love him and ends up throwing himself in the mill pond. But it's really a much deeper cycle about the difficult, doom-laden nature of sexual love and a character at the centre who can't cope with sexual love. And Schubert at that time was in hospital suffering from the early stages of syphilis.
We're talking with Ian Bostridge. His new book is Schubert's Winter Journey, Anatomy of an Obsession. Listeners, you can join us. Are you ready for this journey? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Franz Schubert's great song cycle, Winterreise, Winter Journey, a great German ode to wandering, longing, alienation for a deep winter's day. My guest is Ian Bostridge, wonderful English tenor. He's sung this 24-song, intense song cycle, performed it maybe 100 times, and he's written a wonderful new book about it, unpacking all the politics and culture and personal strain and struggle behind it. The book is Schubert's Winter Journey, Anatomy of an Obsession. That obsession is his own with this music. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join us this hour. Are you ready to engage with the great winter's wandering and alienation of a great German composer from nearly 200 years ago? Can you hear the beginnings of the modern here? Nothing to cling to, nothing to be sure of. Can you relate to this form? Just piano and tenor and emotion. Does it still reach you? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Behind us right here, Der Lindenbaum, the most famous song from this cycle. And Ian Bostridge, one of the most beloved songs in the German songbook.
Yeah, it was taken up into sort of scouting manuals. People would go off on German hikes in the Lederhosen singing this song or a version of it, not even really knowing it was by Schubert. And it then passed into the literary tradition. Thomas Mann's great novel, The Magic Mountain, ends with its protagonist falling over in a muddy landscape during the First World War, singing this song to himself. And for Thomas Mann, this song was all about death, and he thought it was connected to the 19th century German obsession with death, which he saw as something unhealthy and I try and argue against that in the book and say that actually this song is more about memory than about death.
About memory, though, it's been seen many ways. Lyrics here: at the well before the gate, there stands a linden tree. I dreamt in its shade, so many a sweet dream. But you quote Freud saying, well, look, all roads lead to death, so death is the point. I mean, the obsession, if you will, was very strong, even in this song cycle, Shirley.
Yes, I mean, he tried, but I think it gets stronger as the cycle goes on. I mean, we end up towards the end of the cycle with the protagonist wakes up and finds his hair, he thinks his hair's gone white, and it's gone white because it's covered in ice, and he's disappointed when the snow melts, because it means he's got yet more time to live, if only he was closer to the grave. And then even nearer to the end, the song called The Graveyard, where he begs to be given entrance and given a place to rest in the graveyard, and he imagines the graveyard as a sort of a pub. Yeah. And the landlord of the pub says, no, you can't rest here, you've got to carry on. And so the idea, in a way, is that you need to carry on. You have to carry on in the face of all this feeling of emptiness and meaninglessness. But death doesn't triumph in the piece, I don't think.
Barry in Blackfoot, Idaho, is calling. Hi, Barry. You're on the air with the great Ian Bostridge.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I first encountered Venerice when I was going to school at the University of Idaho several years ago, mm-hmm. and I had a teacher who played just Der Lindenbaum for us. I then went and I liked it so much, I found the whole song cycle and listened to it, and it, to me, is one of the very best pieces of music out there.
What about it, Barry? What exactly about it? It is maybe modern in its aesthetics, and it's, grabbing onto the emptiness that can be in life, but it's not contemporary in its sound. You've got to do some time travel to appreciate. How do you grab it?
You know, with me, like, I've actually gone and I've got the music for it. I've sung it in, you know, church talent shows and things with my wife.
Yeah.
Well, not the whole thing, obviously, but it's so incredibly human. The tension and whatever with it. When you think about, like, the end of it, I like to think of it as what happens with it is he's dying of hypothermia, and he's hallucinating. He's seeing, like, drei Sonnen, and he's seeing three suns. I mean, that's not normal. But to me, if nothing else, what I love about Schubert and Winterreise in particular is just how you get such an expressiveness of the human voice. I've got the recording of Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau doing it, and I love listening to it. So.
Oh, Barry, I'm so glad for your call from Idaho. Ian, there's a fellow obsessive with this.
Yeah. I think what it gives credence to is the idea that, you know, it can mean so many things to so many people. I mean, in the book, I explore lots of different avenues, lots of different perspectives. But in the end, there are so many different personal perspectives that one can bring to it. And this idea, for example, of hypothermia, which is one I hadn't come across before, but is a great idea for what happens to the traveler at the end of the piece.
It is a deeply cold environment there, and let's listen to a little bit here of Frozen Stiff, Erstarrung. In Bostridge, you write here a pre-epic tempest of repressed urgency and desire for release, above all a sexual quality, a long way from hypothermia in that.
Yeah, I mean, in this song, I think there's all this scurrying around. You can hear it in the piano, passionate desire to penetrate into the earth and uncover it and find the love that he's lost. It's extraordinary, I think. It's one of the most extraordinary songs in the piece. And this sort of quality doesn't really come back in the piece. This you can hear it, this driving, urgent quality.
Jackie,
and this is song number four.
Yes, just right off the bat. Jackie in Melrose, Massachusetts, you're on. What do you hear, Jackie?
Well, I'm so happy to hear one of your programs dealing with music. I always love your programs anyway. but music is such a great thing to have, and not enough people have heard these things. A couple years ago, I arranged for a very good baritone to be singing Die Schöne Müllerin here, and we had a good throng waiting for it. But Schubert was such a sad man, as I guess you've been mentioning, but he never received really the adulation that he deserved while he was living. And he died fairly young and did have a hard life, as you were mentioning, but he's still not appreciated. You don't hear these great works, these great choral works, and these song cycles often enough, I guess because not too many people are capable of singing them all the way through, but they are unique in all the categories of music. There's nothing as sensitive and as moving as these two song cycles by Schubert. So I'm so delighted to have you here. I once heard Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau singing Die Schöne Müllerin when I was in Chicago, and it was,
wow.
I've never forgotten how marvelous. He was so expressive. He was so sensitive to all the feelings of Schubert.
We've got another great interpreter with us right here. Of course, he's the great famed, but so is Ian right here. Jackie, thank you. Ian?
No, I mean, I saw Fischer-Dieskau sing about five recitals of Lieder. I never saw him do Winterreise, sadly. I never saw him do Schöne Müllerin, and I would have loved to. He had an incredible presence on stage. That's the other thing we mustn't forget about this piece, is it was written and first performed by Schubert to a group of friends in his own sort of sitting room, him playing the piano and singing along to his own accompaniment. But it's actually gone on to have this life in concert halls. And it's in that context, it's an incredibly dramatic piece, I think. And the physical presence of the singer and the way the singer works through the emotions in the piece physically, I think, is a very important part of its impact on the audience.
Ian, you remind us, Schubert was kind of a forerunner of a new class of artist or musician here. He did not have a patron in the church or in someone from royalty. He was actually sort of, in a modern parlance, we'd say, in the marketplace. He was making his own living on his own hook.
Yeah, and he's pretty much, certainly of the composers who we know and are a part of the mainstream, you know, the Beethovens, the Bachs, the Mozarts, he's the first, really. And you see that reflected in the work, because of the very last song, the most, in a way, the most extraordinary and bare and lonely song of all, Der Leiermann, the Hurdy-Gurdy Man, is about a poverty-stricken musician. Nobody's listening to him. Nobody's giving him any money. He's outside the village, outside the community, outside human society, and replaying this endlessly repetitive theme. It's like a play, a terrible play by Samuel Beckett. And I think it's what Schubert partly feared for himself and how he saw himself.
In a way, making his own way with his musical talent was a part of the problem in his life, the very reactionary kind of restrictive regime of that time. If I read you correctly, Ian, he could not marry because a musician or artist was deemed by definition not to have the means to marry.
Yes, I mean, he needed to get a job, and he didn't. He tried to get a position, and after he'd failed to get a position in the early 1820s, he wrote this rather heart-stricken letter saying, you know, it's terrible to be in this position now and to be a prey to sort of mindless sensuality, as he puts it. He wanted to have a companion, but he didn't have a companion. But at the same time, we wouldn't have this music, I suppose, if he'd been, you know, married with six kids and teaching music in Laibach.
Instead, he was with apparently prostitutes, then syphilis, then the road to death. The character in the song cycles you describe as obsessively confessional soul, apparently an emotional exhibitionist. That seems, in a way, the opposite of the modern. That seems to throw back to the romantic Byron.
I think that there is an element of that, definitely, but I think it goes beyond that because partly because this tragedy is so domestic. With Byron, what you've got is this idea that the person who's at the centre of a Byron poem is certainly of things like the bigger poems. I mean, before Don Juan, not the comic poems. You get this sense of somebody who's committed great crimes. They're never quite named, but they're terribly grand. Whereas what we have here is something that's very local and ordinary, which is that a guy is split up with a girl, and that is what has brought on this existential anxiety. And that's very, in its very ordinariness, it's very sort of democratic, I suppose, and modern in that way.
hear from Winter Journey, Winterreise, Der Greise, the Kopf, the old man's head.
Doch bald ist hinweggetaut, hab wieder schwarze Haare, das mir's vor meiner Jugend graut.
In Bastard, you write, this song, musically so arresting, so new, so different. Explain that to us.
I think it's partly in that the way it starts, the piano line is so stretched and uses such strange intervals. It just sounds very awkward and very pained and bare in a way that I can't think of any music before it sounding. And it's addressing, it is this song that's addressing the idea of wanting to be old but not being able to achieve that age which is going to bring death nearer. But there's this extraordinary moment in this piece where the singer sings, how far is it to the grave? And then there's silence. And it's almost as if the singer is addressing members of the audience and saying, when will death come? And in a way, that's something that in our world we don't want to address. We don't address the coming of death. We don't want to talk about it. But it's something that's there for all of us and that waits and hangs there, I suppose. It's almost a moment of embarrassment in the cycle, I think.
So naked, you write...
Naked is the word.
It sounds simply, you write, weirder than anything that has gone before, more dissociated, more alienated, more strange. You call this song cycle, Winterreise, A Winter Journey, the first and greatest of concept albums. All right, the Beatles and others are listening. Make your case.
It's simply the idea that it is a set of songs that length. It's rather than the individual songs which had gone before. It's an enormous work. It's an enormous journey that we take, 75 minutes, and nothing like that had happened before. And it's only, and I make the comparison because that's something that does happen in these very ambitious cycles of songs that were made in the 60s and 70s with the coming of the LP. You think of the Beatles and Sgt. Pepper, and I suppose people have made a case that Sgt. Pepper is a song cycle about loneliness. I'm not sure whether one can really quite put that together. It's more of a miscellany, maybe. But there are certainly other albums of that period that try to do something as ambitious. Yeah.
Carl in Key West, Florida, you're on the air with Ian Bostridge. Carl, thanks for calling.
Schubert repeatedly tried to get Goethe's attention, wrote to him, was ignored, probably because Goethe, for all his poetic brilliance, had a tone deaf ear as to music. But more important, the Schubertiads and the gatherings that Schubert held with his friends. Schubert, like so many of that era, was melancholy and death-oriented because he was homosexual and closeted. No one mentions that.
Ian, you write about it quite pointedly. What do you say?
I think we don't know very much about the details of Schubert's sexuality. There was a big controversy in musicological circles in the 90s when a writer called Maynard Solomon tried to demonstrate that there was strong evidence for Schubert having had a homosexual lifestyle, and he described it as his primary sexual orientation. And certainly Schubert hung around with a lot of people who wrote homoerotic poetry. Like a lot of young men, he may have been drawn towards that, but we don't actually know anything concrete about that, whereas we do concretely know from the evidence given by his friends and the evidence of letters as well, that he had an unconsummated and, in the end, unfulfilling relationship with a local girl early on in his life, and that he fell in love with the Countess von Esterhazy when he was teaching her later in the 1820s. And you could say that Solomon tries to argue that's all cover for his homosexuality, and that may be true, but certainly there's no very positive, for me, compelling evidence that he was definitely homosexual.
Though there's certainly been a lot written and said on just that front. Ian Bostridge, singer of what you hear behind us right now, wonderful tenor, and author of the new book Schubert's Winter Journey, Anatomy of an Obsession. Ian, please stand by. New York listeners, you can join us. Do you know the feeling that we're hearing here? Cast out, wandering, full of doubt, eyeing death. Is this too much for you? Just too much? Or does it grab your understanding of the human condition, your human condition. 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. It's Tom Ashbrook with Ian Brostridge talking about Winterreise, Schubert's winter journey. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast. As special thank you, Audible.com would like to offer you a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial membership. Audible has over 150,000 titles, fiction, nonfiction, bestsellers, every category imaginable. They also have tons of exclusive content you can't get anywhere else. Just go to audible.com/onpoint, choose a free book and listen. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint. Get started today.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're listening to Franz Schubert's great song cycle of Lieder, Winterreise. Ian Bostridge sings it behind us here. This is Mut, Courage. Song 22 out of 24. His wonderful new book is Schubert's Winter Journey, Anatomy of an Obsession. You can join us, 800-423-8255. Ian Bostridge joins us from New York. This song ends, Courage, Mut. If there's not God on earth, we are gods ourselves. And you, Ian, call Mut, this song, a battle hymn of the unbeliever. What do you mean?
I think it's... It's got that quality of aggression and exaltation as well in the idea that one could be responsible to oneself on earth. I don't think that that's something that Schubert necessarily bought into wholeheartedly himself. I think Schubert's got that Shakespearean quality of negative capability, of being able to represent different points of view very convincingly. And I think it's as if he's trying on the atheist costume to see how it will work. And I don't think that's necessarily the overarching sense of the piece. And Schubert was certainly not straightforward about his religious beliefs during his life, I think.
Did he understand himself as sensing something new? If you had said, oh, Schubert, you're proto-modern in your song cycle, if you could go back and have a conversation with him, would he have any idea what you were talking about?
I don't think he would have sensed himself as modern, because I don't think there was an ideology of, mm-hmm. of modernism, which mm-hmm. is what we did get in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like a lot of writers writing then, he anticipated modernism. And I think the reason I want to bang on about it and make such a big thing is because people might see Schubert's song as being very remote from their concerns, as being very rooted in the past and as being somehow sort of warm and fluffy and sentimental. And what I want to say is, well, no, it's quite hard-edged, very related to our modern concerns. And one of the reasons is because a lot of our modern concerns came to birth in that very period in the 1820s with the idea that the universe might be empty and meaningless, which was becoming a possible idea at least in the 1820s, and with the beginning of the triumph of the marketplace, which also creates its own stresses and strains for the individual who doesn't feel at home in the marketplace.
I would say so. Larry in Buffalo, New York. Larry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to preface my comment. This couldn't be better timed, at least where I'm at. I haven't come in from digging out of a foot of snow.
Yes, it's very wintry here too, Larry. Perfect soundtrack.
So I was introduced to this piece about 5 years ago by a local tenor here in Buffalo by the name of David Pizarro, who actually had become an expatriate in England, and he had created a DVD where he hiked the middle, skinniest section of the UK from coast to coast and had it filmed and during the winter, and he would stop in at the end of the day at each town to sing selections from Die Winterreise and then start the next day. And wow. His own travel, his own hike, was itself a tremendous struggle. It was very rigorous. And then to sing each evening was, he was experiencing as he hiked the sort of the same pain and suffering that he expressed in the music and that the music expresses.
Oh, it's a great idea. Yeah.
What a great story, Larry. Thank you very much for calling in with that. I want to be sure we get to the last song in the cycle, Der Leiermann, the hurdy-gurdy man. Let's listen.
Und er lässt es gehen, alles wie es will. Dreht und seine Leine steht ihm nimmer still.
The Leiermann, the hurdy-gurdy man, last strange song of the cycle. You paint a picture for us, Ian Bostridge, of him, sort of a beggar man, cold and ragged and playing the humblest sort of music in the snow at the very end. Pointing to what there?
Pointing to, I think, as I said, this fear of Schubert as the outsider musician, somebody who doesn't have a place in society. A fear of the meaninglessness, the possible meaninglessness of the music. I mean, what we have is music at its absolute bare minimum here, repetition of the same phrase over and over again, and also played on this instrument that is absolutely a mechanical instrument, because what's happening is it's like a bagpipe, but it's the stringed version of it. So it's a drone, a mechanical drone. Basically, the lyre player is winding a metal
just
wheel
cranking
against some
it.
Strings.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not really, it's mechanistic. It's not even really very human most instruments, when they're played, like if you play a violin or a cello, mm-hmm. or even the piano, mm-hmm. you're trying to approximate to this sound of the human, and mm-hmm. there's something very inhuman, I think, about the hurdy-gurdy.
Here comes the mechanized Jerry in Austin, Texas. You're on the air, Jerry.
Yeah, boy, I have to say, I'm so excited to get to hear this, because this is what I send money to NPR to get to hear, so thank you. I admire your work and have, especially since your early recordings of Dichterliebe. And one thing I just want to say, and you're really demonstrating it here, is your understanding of the background, the historical roots of all this, just gives so much dimension to what this music is about, and glad to hear that. And I wish we could have more of this, because this music becomes so much more understandable in the context, and so much music education doesn't address that. I do want to quickly drop that I was a student of Georges Sauzet, and I heard his very last performance of Winterreise, which was chilling. And my son is a singer, and he learned most of Winterreise in college and just got through teaching his first lesson to a student and taught him Der Lindenbaum. But I do have a question for you. I'm curious what you think of Sting's performing Der Leiermann, recording it.
I mean, in theory, I think it's fine, but listening to it, it doesn't draw me particularly. I mean, I talk in the book about different styles of singing and trying to find a raw way of singing Der Leiermann, for example, without going too much over the top. And I suppose I find with the Sting version, it's too far away from what's in the music. But I think it was a great attempt and a great thing to try. And maybe I'm too sort of closed up with my classical music mind. But
Jerry, there's so much detail in this book. You must get it. You will be thrilled at all the context that Ian Bostridge offers. Ian, you've sung this so many times. You describe stark silence that often follows the end of this song cycle. What's happening in people's minds at that moment after 70 minutes of this intense walk in the cold?
They're sort of dazed by the impact of it, because if it's gone well, it's been a single arc. And I think one of the very important things to achieve in the performance of the piece is not to let any tension lag between the pieces. And so you've been carried along for what is a very, 70 minutes to be on one arc in a concert is a long time. And I think people are dazed by what they've been through, and they don't really know what to make of it. And certainly as a performer, you come away really slightly shell-shocked.
Ian Bostridge, your singing and performance is marvelous. Your book is a terrific journey, Schubert's Winter Journey, Anatomy of an Obsession. We're very grateful to you for being with us today. Thanks so much for doing all of this.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Ian Bostridge, with us there from New York, and a little more from Wittereise, Die Bebensonnen, The Mock Suns. In a moment, we'll look at German music from a completely different direction. What's popular in Germany right now? This is On Point. Oh boy, here we go. Franz Schubert may be considered the height of class and culture in German circles, but that got us thinking, what are Germans actually listening to these days? We were introduced to German Schlager music on that front. Helene Fischer behind me with Und morgen früh kuss ich dich wach, or And Tomorrow I Kiss You Awake, one of the biggest stars of Schlager music. With us now from Bremen, Germany, to talk a little about German pop music and Schlager music is Ralf von Appen, pop music expert. He's on the board of the German Society for Popular Music Studies. Ralf von Appen, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
So what is Schlager music, sir?
Well, Schlager music has a very long tradition in Germany. It may have roots in the operetta and in the film songs of the 1930s. It's been very big in the 60s and 70s and is seeing some kind of a revival right now with the success of Helene Fischer.
Is it sort of, I don't know, just pop? Is it kind of got a country edge to it, do I hear? There's a little oompa going on there.
Oh, yeah, there might be a little oompa, and it can be compared to country music, but it's not of a, it's not regional in Germany. It's all over the place. It might be compared to country because critics look down upon it as lowbrow music, and it's not a music for the youth, but rather for the adult market.
Do people dance to this music?
So most people will sing along and do their housework and ironing, I guess. But there may be some people dancing to it.
I don't know what I hear here. A little Celine Dion or maybe a touch of Taylor Swift. I'm not sure. Helene Fischer, let's listen to another. This one's Breathlessly Through the Night. Atemlos durch die Nacht.
Atemlos durch die Nacht.
Ralf, I don't know, after nearly an hour of Franz Schubert, this is kind of hurting my head. This is very simple music. Where are people listening to this in Germany? In a beer hall?
Oh, it's so big. He's sold more than 9 million albums, so it's
wow.
Only in the beer houses.
Like, yes.
It's really the most popular German artist right now. And you hear her music everywhere, really. She has her own TV show. It's in the discotheques. It's when the German football team won their cup. She was there to celebrate them and sang this song. So it's everywhere.
And so the lyrics, are they sort of feel-good lyrics about, love and home and sunshine or what?
Well, it's not always sunshine. It's about problems married people have usually. Problems, everyday problems of adults. And lots about love, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's not always sunshine there.
And for popularity in Germany, would Helene Fischer and the big German artists be, at the top of the charts, or would that be a foreign artist from the UK or France or US?
Well, if you look at the singles chart, then it's mostly US pop songs like Taylor Swift, Hozier, or Bruno Mars. Our current number one is The Hanging Tree from the Hunger Games soundtrack, and we have a lot of electronic dance music by DJs like David Guetta or Calvin Harris. But if you look to the albums, that's a completely different picture. We have 7 out of 10 albums from German artists sung in German.
Let's get a little different flavor here. If we let the Schlager music and Helene Fischer float away for a moment, we're going to hear something from Kraftklub, another big song. Introduce us to Kraftklub, and then we'll listen.
Yeah, that's something completely different than Helene Fischer. This is for the youth. This is from their second album. Both albums hit number one in Germany. It's like punk rock with some kind of rap vocals. And their song, Unsere Fans, which translates to Our Fans, is very funny because it accuses their fans of having sold out and of going mainstream. So the old idea of authenticity is turned around to the fans.
A little okay, the fans have sold out. A little punk, a little rock, kind of rap vocals. Unsere Fans, our fans from Kraft Club.
Unsere Fans haben sich verändert, unsere Fans haben sich verkauft. Unsere Fans sind jetzt mainstream. Unsere Fans haben sich verändert, unsere Fans haben sich verkauft. Unsere Fans sind jetzt mainstream. Für 100.000, da stehen wir jetzt gar nicht an.
Kraft Club there. Ralph, what are they saying to their fans? Exactly how have they sold out by this song's lyrics?
Well, they don't even the name of the bassist's brother, for example. They are not really into it with their hearts. And, it's just witty how they turn the idea of selling out on their fans.
So this is the youth music. What about hip-hop? There's a little bit of a hip-hop sound in the lyrics right there. Is hip-hop big in Germany these days, Rob?
Hip-hop is big. The current number one on the album chart is by an artist called Vega, Chaos. And he's from Frankfurt, from the Frankfurt area, and is, gangster rap, hardcore rap.
Gangster. And what about the old traditions of Lieder? We've been listening to Schubert all hour. Would the crowd that listens to Kraft Club spend 5 minutes with Schubert's Lieder?
No, they wouldn't, I'm sure. Lieder is not popular with the mainstream audience or with the youth audience right now.
We've been hearing a lot about cultural tensions, even ethnic tensions in Germany these days, Pegida and all of that. Would they listen to this?
The Kraft Club? Probably, but it's not a right-wing band or anything like that. There's not much music right now that really focuses on these cultural questions. It's not in the mainstream.
So, and what about you, Ralph? When you load your playlist, 99% German, or how much of your own list is music from abroad?
I don't like German music at all. I like the Kraft Club song, but I usually listen to American music.
I wonder what Franz Schubert would make of Kraft Club. What do you say, sir?
Oh, that's really too far away. I don't know if he would understand that.
Speechless at the question. Well, he wrote Hurdy Gurdy Man there to end his Winterreise, so maybe he'd have something to relate to there. Ralph von Appen in Bremen, Germany, musicologist at the University of Gießen and with the German Society for Popular Music Studies. Herr von Appen, thank you very much for joining us for a few minutes today.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. A little more. Helene Fischer here. This is Fairlefly. Accurate. Well, make of it what you will. It's Schlager music. Franz Schubert, thanks for your song cycle. Helene Fischer, maybe we'll listen. Thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.